not the usual City in Exile theme, but it'll have to do since Matthew Finch and the Poisoned Arts crew are in absentia this week. But this is City in Exile for this week. It's 2 minutes after 10. Oh, wait a second. Say a couple of words there, Ken.
A couple of words, Ken. No. This is Ken Gale. You're listening to WBAI-FM 99.5 in New York City. So enough said, we'll fill the entire hour this week, which fits in with the announcement that we have that starting the first Tuesday in April, we will be filling this entire hour every week.
This is a presage of things to come.
Yes. So we just heard about it, and now we're doing it, so we got to do it right.
And this will be our new home. Hey, isn't that amazing? Isn't that fun? I thought we were going to, you know, find some spot after midnight.
Who knows,
at some point.
And so we'll be, with the full hour, we'll go back to taking phone calls with our guests and everything that regular listeners know all about, and you new listeners will find out what all the shouting's about. If there's any shouting at all. And our guest this week is Alexei Kondratiev, who is both a fiction and a nonfiction author. Those of you who remember when we interviewed Alvin Schwartz about his Tibetan story and stuff like that, I think this might be similar to that, although maybe even more fun. But no Sydney Smith to help us out.
So, shall we go into our regular Nuff Said theme?
Yeah.
Okay. Before I say that, I just want to say, I think that tomorrow night, St. Patrick's Day, lots of police overtime will be being done at checkpoints, checking for inebriated drivers. And there will probably be a lot of cars that they're going to be trying to impound. So if you're out there drinking,
look for the auction lists.
If you're out there drinking, don't drive. And if you're driving, don't drink.
But you might spill your drink.
That's right. But either way, take very good care. And here's the Nuff Said theme, and we'll go into the regular show right after. And welcome. We don't have news this week. I looked through it. Now, there's not really anything, you know, that much pressing.
Jim Shooter's not at Marvel yet.
So
there's the mass firings.
No, but I mean, last week I'm looking at somebody's newspaper and you know, they're still fighting it out over R.J. Reynolds now.
Mm. Oh, actually, I do have a bit of news.
Carl Icahn and Ron Perlman are still battling it out just in another arena.
Okay, well, the creator of The Phantom and Mandrake the Magician died several days ago. Lee Falk was in his 70s. He'd been writing both The Phantom and Mandrake since the 30s, created the characters. And Fred Fredericks, the current artist on Mandrake, will take over the writing of that strip. I don't know who's taking over the writing of The Phantom. But Lee Falk is another one of the giants of comics. And in fact, the Phantom was a ray of hope for the people in Nazi-occupied Norway, because the Nazis, of course, controlled the newspapers. And the editors there managed to get smuggled copies of The Phantom comic strip from Sweden. And the Nazis would have all these newspaper articles about how they had bombed New York City and they destroyed Washington and don't look for the Americans for hope because we got them too. Except that the people reading The Phantom knew, well, The Phantom's still coming out. Everything must be fine over there. So they knew better. And in fact, the password of the Norwegian underground was Phantom. Anyway, so that was Lee Falk's creation, so we would definitely had to mourn his passing.
Ah, yes. I had not heard that one.
Yeah.
So, that probably came out before, after the deadline.
Yes, in fact, it would have, right.
The Comic Book Electronic Magazine.
Right, Comic Book Net comes out on Fridays, and I think this happened during the weekend.
Yeah.
It was, I believe the obituary was in the Daily News on Monday. And so anyway.
Anyway, on to
our guest, Alexei Kondratiev, the creator and author of Vitrix the Druid, the author of The Apple Branch, A Path to Celtic Ritual, a book published in Ireland and difficult to get in this country. The distributor keeps running out of copies.
That's right, and they haven't done much advertising.
Almost none, except people still manage to find out about it enough that the distributor keeps selling out.
That's encouraging, yeah.
Well, yeah, it's encouraging. Well, there's two ways to look at it. Is why didn't he get enough copies in the first place and in the second place?
Mm-hmm.
Or it's just, you know, going so well. I hope so. Yeah, I hope it's the latter.
Right.
But, I mean, that's two different writing styles, writing comic books and writing a nonfiction book like The Apple Branch.
Extremely different.
Compare them. One is entertainment that has a lot of information in the background, and one is information that's entertaining to read.
Well, yes, first of all, in a comic book, you have a lot less space to indulge in.
Right. Right?
You have to be as concise as possible to get your message across. You can't have characters developing theses in speech. Everything that is presented verbally has to be extremely concise. And you're really working with images more than with verbal content. So you have to pay a lot of attention to symbolism, to things that will grab people and make them associate it with certain ideas, certain concepts that are important to them, so that you're not persuading people through a rational argument. You're getting them on your side by making them see things your way. Yeah, it's
but of course, in a prose book, you're missing all that visual impact.
Well, yes, but you're arguing with the reader. That is, you're convincing the reader of certain concepts, of the validity of certain concepts. Mm-hmm. So you're developing arguments. Whereas with a comic book, since you're doing it visually, you're doing it through storytelling and through the impact of certain very simple messages, you have to learn how to pinpoint, how to focus, and that's why it can so easily fall flat. You don't have...
Now, I noticed in The Apple Branch, you were talking a lot about the struggles of Celtic culture throughout the years. You were talking about, you know, the golden ages of the Celts and the ending of those and when they flowered again. And you also... You're talking about the pan-Celtic experience, that all the different Celtic countries around now, you know, Ireland, Scotland, etc., have more together than separately. But you were talking in groups in The Apple Branch, whereas in Vitrix the Druid, you were giving us the stories of individuals from different time periods.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well,
and so you were doing an individual's approach.
Again, because the reader of the comic book is going to identify with the characters that he sees portrayed in the story in front of him. So you identify emotionally with the main character, the protagonist in the adventure, and the whole art of the presentation in the comic book is to get you to see it from that character's perspective. Mm-hmm. And from this participation in the character's life, then you sort of learn all of the things that a textbook would be teaching you in a much more... elaborate and wordy manner.
You know, when I suddenly realized those two approaches, I thought of Steven Spielberg movies, who even when he's dealing with, like in Schindler's List, okay, mm-hmm. he's dealing with the clash of two cultures, mm-hmm. but he does it all from the point of view of individuals.
Well, in many ways, screenwriting and comic book scripting work from the same principles, right? You have a much larger production when you're dealing with a movie and a lot more ammunition from the visual mm-hmm. point of the production. But the comic book writer is essentially trying to do the same thing on a much more modest canvas and get the same kind of participation from the audience.
And comic book editors say the same thing that people who teach directors say, which is mm-hmm. show, don't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way to show that is through an individual's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting approach. You also, in Vitrix, you take all of the time periods that you go through, you know, in subchapters in The Apple Branch, and you put them together as characters. I remember you telling me that you're treating each time period that Vitrix travels in as a character.
Exactly, yes. It's it gives you a certain illustration of what the Celtic experience has been like. in different countries and different time periods. And all of those experiences are still part of the Celtic world. They're all part of the what everybody who belongs to a Celtic culture has gone through in some way.
Well, now that we've confused everybody, what are you talking about? You know, all these concepts. Why don't you explain the story of Itarix the Druid and then talk a little bit about the apple branch?
Oh, well, the story of Itarix the Druid was basically an illustration of the problems of living in a small culture that is strongly rooted in the land. And when it comes into contact with a large culture that is not specific to a particular land or country, that is simply based on the accumulation of power and material goods. Mm-hmm. And this sort of struggle for identity and for survival of one particular way of experiencing the world, as opposed to the sort of mega culture, what's called a muck world or world mart or whatever some people have called it, which is basically a way of trying to reduce everything to one single common denominator so that mm-hmm. things are easier to control. And when you choose diversity, when you choose individuality, when you choose a particular viewpoint, you make yourself vulnerable because you're going against the grain of this large standardizing, simplifying process of empire, you know, that people who build empires are engaged in. And I'm showing how at different periods and in different places these forces have confronted each other. So Vidrix is someone who lives originally in the first century of our era, at the time when the Romans destroyed the primary druidical sanctuary that was on the island of Mona, which is the island that's called Anglesey now, off the north coast of Wales. And in around 60 AD, there was a military campaign by the governor of Britain at that time, the Roman military governor, who was Suetonius Paulinus, and who decided to put an end to the Druids' power because they were the spiritual backbone of the Celtic world. They kept Celtic culture alive. They kept Celtic religion alive. They kept the sense of Celtic identity alive, prevented it from being that easily absorbed into
Roman. And it's about the only
society.
Centralized part of Celtic culture.
Exactly.
And the Romans always looking for the center.
Exactly. That was what made it all hold together when there was no political centralization of any kind. Celtic tribes are completely independent from each other. They didn't cooperate with each other. There was no institution that would have forced them to cooperate. The only cement that was holding them together was language and this type of religion, this type of poetic and theological tradition that they respected, and that was international in the sense that people from many different tribes could come together and study the same tradition. So the Romans tried to destroy that. So I portray Vidarix as coming from this institution, this first flowering of the Celtic world, and escaping through time with the help of Celtic gods. And
good thing they were there.
Yes, good thing they were there and that he knew how to invoke them. But he is then forced to try and reassemble what made the cohesion of the Celtic world. And I portray that in the comic book as the device of the treasures of Britain in Celtic mythology. We have this notion that society was originally held together by magical objects that represent the different functions that are necessary for the tribe to function correctly and to be properly in balance with the land. So I imagine these treasures as having originally existed in Mona. Again, that's a comic book thesis to hold the story together. And then they get scattered in time to prevent the Romans from getting them. But then they have to be reassembled. So Vidrix is trying to reassemble them. And of course, the different tools, these different treasures, these different magical objects, wind up in different periods and different places. So he travels through time and space in order to obtain them. So this allows us to glimpse different periods of Celtic history. He goes into visits the island of Iona and the monastery there, sort of at the time when it was being attacked by the Vikings, and this whole flowering of Celtic Christianity was coming to an end. So that was another attempt at reintegrating the Celtic world and showing it how it's being destroyed again. But Vidarix manages to save one aspect of it. And, of course, he gains his first companion in his quest from that adventure. Then the third episode was supposed to take place in present-day Brittany. and it, I used...
Brittany is part of France.
Right. Well,
so to speak.
So to speak, right. It belongs politically to France, but it's a very different country. And I used as the background the anti-nuclear protests that played such an enormous role in Brittany around 1980. And use a person who was involved in those protests as the point of view character for that episode.
And it's really neat because, of course, Vitterix reacts to 20th century Brittany differently than, of course, we would. And of course, the monk from the 9th century also reacts differently. So so as you're reading Vitterix, you're getting the action through the points of view of different people coming at it from their own perspective and their own prejudices.
Right, but they all form part of one single whole.
Mm-hmm.
That is, all of their experiences make up what has been Celtic history, and the sum total of those experiences still add up to what the Celtic identity is today. So that's
It's interesting. A lot of science fiction uses Celtic themes, but they almost never take place in the 20th century.
No, because it's part of our dominant culture's defensive reaction against these types of minority cultures that it has destroyed. Is to say that they were great, they have a lot of romantic appeal, but they were in the past. They don't exist anymore. And you try and create as much distance as possible between the present-day situation and these other cultures with their other viewpoints, so that they're kept safely at a distance. They're not directly relevant to what's happening.
Well, it's the equivalent of seeing a newspaper account of, say, the civil disobedience in Wall Street at police plaza, and they call it vaguely reminiscent of the 60s, trying to sort of push that into the past.
Right.
Like, nobody's really protesting the police now. They're just sort of throwbacks to the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the same idea.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, the Celts are just throwbacks to 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in Vitterix, I was presenting everything from a Celtic point of view.
Yeah. And now, in the Apple Branch, that's where you really go into detail. Tell us about what that book is about.
Well, that's, of course, a completely different thing because I was not... it's basically an attempt at educating people about what the Celtic world is, that there is an overarching reality behind what it has been historically through the ages. I'm presenting Celtic tradition, what has survived of Celtic tradition within communities that speak Celtic languages, as an alternative way of looking at the world, which I think is particularly important to people in Western civilization because it is a Western culture. It's not like taking, you know, Native Americans or people in the Pacific or whatever who have very different cultures and relate to the land in very different ways. But also, because they're in completely different parts of the world, they can very easily be misunderstood by Westerners who study them because their whole frame of reference is completely different. Whereas Celtic civilization does not have a totally different frame of reference. Mm. It evolved in the same geographical region as more dominant expressions of Western culture, and yet it looks at things completely differently. So being very much aware of the environmental crisis in which our planet is right now and the difficulty that our civilization has in coming to grips with it and doing anything concretely helpful about it, just basically moaning about what's happening, but then letting all of our institutional habits continue to contribute to the problem without really doing anything about them. I was saying, well, let's look at it from a completely different approach. Let's look at it from the point of view of a culture that was forced by its own economic circumstances, to have a very different attitude about nature, about its natural environment, and how through belief and ritual, it was constantly aware of the need of maintaining a balance between the needs of the human community and the reality of nature, of your physical environment. These are the concepts that in the Apple Branch I call tribe and land. Tribe is the human community. Humans have certain needs for a human society to be viable. It has to have certain conditions be met that permit people to live in a healthy environment, in a safe environment, in an environment that's stimulating and that allows people to feel comfortable about themselves and to look forward to something. So, yes, you know, you have to order your environment in some way so that the random forces of nature don't wipe you out. You have to have some form of technological way of making yourself safe. But at the same time, you can't forget that you're not isolated from nature. You're not isolated from this planet. You're not pure spirits that are living in a dead material framework, that you're actually a part of a much larger structure. And you fit inside that structure. You're not outside it. And when you're dependent on your physical environment completely, when you know that the food that you eat, the shelter that you get is dependent on cycles in nature, that certain conditions have to be met in relation to nature, adapting to nature for your survival to be assured.
There's no cycles in nature. Just go to the supermarket.
But that's what happens now. If you live in a culture where that's clear, that you depend on the cycles of nature, then you're forced to create different attitudes to accommodate, to make yourself aware of those natural cycles all the time. And you do this through myth and ritual, which are constantly adjusting your way of looking at things so that you don't fall into the trap that our civilization has fallen into, because we had sort of technological windfalls that allowed us to control our environment according to our whims to an unbalanced degree. So that, like you just said, we no longer realize that our food has to come out of the land. We think that it comes out of the supermarket, and it's the problem of the people who grow it to get it to us.
Right. You know, it's their problem.
It's not our problem. Yeah. Right. And we've conditioned ourselves to have this notion that we no longer have to relate to the land directly. We have created this cocooned environment that is purely human, that is completely developed by human culture, and that no longer has any reference to the cycles of nature or to the specificity of the place that you're in.
Now, you say it's a path to Celtic ritual.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of implies that there's lots of ways of doing this.
Yes. Again, the book was not an attempt at dictating to people, well, you know, if you follow this path, you're really... this is real true Celtic tradition, and you're doing it right, and any other way is wrong. No, I was saying that this is what Celtic tradition is like.
There's a wealth of history.
Right. I try and give the historical background. I try and give an anthropological and folklore background as to what life has been like in traditional Celtic communities.
And you do have a PhD in anthropology, which...
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't?
No, I have I studied anthropology. I have a BA in anthropology.
Oh, BA.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, I don't have a PhD. I never did a doctoral program. I did pursue a program of studies in Celtic studies in Paris at the Hautes Études, and I certainly spent a lot of time living in Celtic-speaking communities and studying Celtic languages and the traditions associated with them. So then I sort of give you this information, and then I say, well, here are several ways in which you can use this by associating with this tradition, by immersing yourself in this tradition, by getting a greater and greater understanding of it. And here are some ways in which you can use the meaning of these rituals to create rituals of your own.
How do you know that the rituals that you give so much detail about in the Apple Branch are accurate?
Well, the rituals are from observation. I mean, the rituals are rituals that exist, that you can look them up in books on anthropology and folklore.
Oh, okay. It's not like that these things were lost and have recently been found.
No, not at all. No, what I'm doing is I'm providing a framework in which I'm bringing all of this together, which is something that hasn't been done to a really developed extent. And I'm also presenting it as relevant to the here and now. That is, these rituals are not just quaint things that people did and that really have no relevance to us now. And I try to explain what these rituals were supposed to mean and how they can still be meaningful when we put ourselves from the point of view of what those rituals were trying to accomplish, that they can still accomplish precisely the same thing in our modern framework.
It's 10:29. This is WBAI-FM 99.5 in New York City. And when you recreate Celtic ritual, you go in it by the seasons. And there's a lot. Now, right now, this is the day before St. Patrick's Day. It's a few days before the spring equinox. St. David's Day is coming out.
It was last week.
I thought it was next week.
Actually, a week before that.
We have Easter coming up. And you talk a lot about those holidays and the roots of them. Let's go into detail since it's so timely right now.
Which one?
Well,
it's being the spring holidays.
Well, all the spring holidays. You've sort of put them as if all the holidays I just mentioned come from the same root.
They do, probably. Now, we don't know that the Celts actually did anything around the time of the spring equinox. That's sort of a modern mm-hmm. convention. And in the Christian, the church calendar, that became Lady Day, Feast of the Annunciation. So it's probable that there was some sort of celebration of spring in Western Europe around that time. Because most Marial holidays that feature the Virgin Mary, are residues of festivals that honored the land goddess of a particular area. There were agricultural festivals uh-huh. in which the land goddess was honored, and usually when these festivals were Christianized, Mary was put in place of the land goddess, but the spirit of the festival remained essentially the same. And in the Celtic calendar, of course, the two major holidays that sort of frame spring are Imolc, which is was Christianized as Candlemas, which is the beginning of February, and was the holiday that was sacred to the goddess Brigid, or became Saint Bridget. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, is before spring actually flowers. It's the first kindling of the fire of spring in the depths of the earth, and it happens when it's still cold on the surface. And then the festival that frames it at the other end, which is Bealtaine, which is the beginning of May Day, which is really the flowering of summer, the sort of the culmination of spring, when everything is now on the surface, everything is manifest, the earth is blooming, and everything is set to grow and reproduce. So somewhere midway between these periods, we have the equinox, and we don't know how it was commemorated in the Celtic world, or if we don't have the name of a Celtic festival that would have anything to do with that. But we do have spring festivals around that time that tended to gravitate towards saints' holidays. And, you know, we have St. David's Day, March 1st in Wales. We have St. Patrick's Day, March 17th in Ireland. Mm-hmm. We have St. Piran's Day, March 5th in Cornwall. So there's the impression that, and all of these are not just national holidays as they've become, you know, honoring the country, but they have a certain earthy quality to them as well, that you're celebrating the season as well as celebrating a saint or celebrating an ethnic identity.
Well, there's a well-known corporation known for its watery beer and conservative politics. It's really pushing the whole St. Patrick chase the snakes out of Ireland.
Yeah, that's very silly. Well, I mean, it's a popular story, and yeah. It's sort of been pushed by you know, Catholic schools and places like that, where you sort of teach children the story of St. Patrick, and that's sort of a picturesque thing you can throw in. It's actually not an old story at all. The first mention of it is sometime in the 12th century as a sort of explanation of why there are no snakes in Ireland. And it's sort of presented as a joke. You know, St. Patrick threw them out. That's why there are no snakes in Ireland. Even though classical writers already pointed out that there were no snakes in Ireland. And the Irish writers of the Middle Ages were perfectly aware of those previous sources talking about mm-hmm. the absence of snakes in Ireland. So it's not like it was an issue that people really believed that St. Patrick drove them out. There's a common modern neo-pagan myth that says that the snakes were druids. That's not true either. You know, a lot of people saying, well, yeah, it's just code word for the druids that Patrick forced out of Ireland. But no, that's not true either. That's just a modern myth that has been repeated so often that people treat it as fact now.
Uh-huh.
The origin of the story was probably that a lot of the pre-Christian myths that dealt with the relationship between the tribe and the land in the early Celtic world and in Ireland dealt with how a culture hero subdued the powers of the earth that are chaotic uh-huh. and that are dangerous for human survival, that are represented by a giant snake, a giant serpent of some sort. And there are a lot of these sort of either serpent slaying or serpent subduing stories that originally involved a god or a hero. Lu, of course, who is the great sort of culture hero, god of the Celts, played that role in many traditions. But during the Middle Ages, as these traditions were gradually Christianized, very often a local saint would be put in the role of the pagan hero or the god
mm-hmm.
and would do exactly the same thing.
Right.
But the name would have changed. And St. Patrick was put in that role, certainly in the the legend of Krugfarik, of the mountain that is has since become sacred to St. Patrick and is the focus of the pilgrimage of St. Patrick in Mayo. Here, Patrick is put in the role of the one who did the serpent slaying, the Kiranach, the evil dragon, female dragon, nice. That is the chaotic power of the land. And so, and then in other places where Patrick often absorbed the roles of lesser-known local saints, as in later in the Middle Ages, the Roman Church, because it considered St. Patrick to be one of their own, and it was sort of nervous about the very independent nature of Irish Christianity and the fact that a lot of the saints and the monasteries and so forth that were institutions in Irish Christian culture couldn't really be given a very confident Roman pedigree. So they really wanted to push St. Patrick because they knew that he was related to the Roman Church in some clear way. And so they pushed Patrick everywhere. And so very often Patrick absorbed other traditions.
So they knew how to co-opt pagan deities, but also...
yes, earlier Christian traditions.
That's great.
Yeah. So the idea of Patrick killing snakes or subduing snakes came from his being identified with these earlier traditions. And again, the idea that he drove the snakes out of Ireland as an explanation for why there are no snakes there is sort of a very late sort of throwaway concept that was really a joke to start with. And then that in more modern times got to be part of the St. Patrick legend as it was standardized.
Yeah. Yeah, you do a great job of very subtly portraying the stress between Irish Christians and Roman Christians in the Vitrix comic, where... Vitrix doesn't understand who Romans are. He, you know, he just saw the Roman army destroy his people. Mm-hmm. So he asks the monk if he's Roman. He goes, well, we just pay lip service to Rome here.
Yeah, well, I tried to show that there were three different tendencies, that there was the Roman church tradition that really feels beholden to Rome and that looks up to Rome for authority. And I had the English monk essentially be the symbol of that, because it was in fact the English clergy that eventually were influential in pulling.
What's that line? The English monk says, "Those Irish always breaking the rules."
Right, exactly. So he represents that tendency, and then you have the Celtic Church tendency, which sees itself as part of the Roman Church, but is very much into its own independence. That is. Feeling that, yes, you can look up to Rome, but what do the Roman authorities have to tell us about the way we run things? They're not in our country.
Right.
They don't know what our communities are like. They have nothing to tell us. And then there's also the substrate of pagan learning. I have the Celtic monks at one point when they need to call upon the spirits of the land to defend the community of Iona. And they all know a lot about the pagan lore, of course. It's not official. It's not a part of their official learning, and it's sort of heretical. It's not really kosher with the church, but they all know about it. And
they were expecting Vitrix's arrival, even. They just didn't know who he would be.
Right. So they're sort of wary of using it, but at the same time, they're not afraid of using it when they really have to.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this sort of undercurrent of pre-Christian knowledge and learning that is... surviving within the Christian context, even though they're, not entirely sure what to make.
And there's that great picture of a Celtic cross that Don Hudson drew that really just takes over, really, the whole story. I mean, that's that's the panel everybody remembers.
Yeah, where I show that the pattern of the Celtic cross, even though it's an overt Christian symbol.
Yeah, well, there's Christ in the middle of it.
Yes, but the structure of the cross conveys pre-Christian traditions about the structure of the world and the year and time and the divinities that rule the different phases of it. And they're all put in the cross, as they are indeed on a lot of Celtic Christian art, where you have pre-Christian ideas that are worked into Christian scenes.
You know, real religion is very rare in fiction. And in fact, publishers actively discourage authors from using real religions.
Mm-hmm.
And there you are, putting real religions, current day, ancient real religions, and you don't make things up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that there's a fear today of what religion represents. And in a way, religion is the most important aspect, I think, of human thinking and human relating. Religion means linking. That's what the word literally means.
Well, publishers are also worried about complaints. If you have a real Christian, well, of course, it's like wish were Christian. If you have an individual character, he's going to be an individual aspect of Christianity. So every reader who is Christian, who doesn't share that aspect, is going to get pissed. Mm-hmm. That's not what they're like.
Well, that depends. If your character is made to represent Christianity or is shown like a mouthpiece for a particular religion, which is not the artistic way of introducing religion.
Yeah, but publishers are afraid that just, you know, you can establish him as, you know, you can give him the character all kinds of background, and people are still going to complain.
Probably.
And publishers are afraid of complaints. Books don't sell well enough to afford to have a bunch of people complaining about them.
Well, yes, but I think that's the risk you take with any good artistic statement. Mm-hmm. Said if it's good, it'll probably offend somebody because it'll touch somebody. You know.
Well, I as someone who sells Vitrix at conventions, yes, it does indeed offend people. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it offends Christians and pagans both.
Well, yes, because I present both views as valid.
So. Yeah. I mean, the pagans are angry that the Christians are good guys, and the Christians are angry that the pagans are good guys, and they're like, well, you know, can we all just get along?
Well, because I think both Vitrix is presented as someone who is attached to the truth, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way he's been trained. So he does not get compartmentalize people that he meets. He simply tests them for their character, you know, whether they're good people or not. And if they're good people, by his experience, by his testing of them, then they're valid. All their views are valid. Everything that goes to make their worldview is also valid. You know, he's not interested in the label that they might have.
In the first issue, the god Lu awakens Vitrix's second sight because he hadn't been trained to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about that in the Apple Branch, about the druidic training, you know, giving the Druids their second sight. What is second sight?
I don't remember I talked about that in the Apple Branch.
Yeah, you mentioned second sight in the Apple Branch.
I mentioned second sight, but second sight is really a, in Celtic tradition as it's come down to us, it's really a gift that people are born with and a talent that people have and that sometimes runs in certain families. It's particularly prevalent in the Highlands. You have a lot of families in the Highlands where people claim to have second sight.
And what is that? What is
second sight is basically an ability to, in certain circumstances, to transcend space and time, to be able to see things that are happening far away, or to be able to be clairvoyant and see events that have not yet taken place, but be able to warn people about them. Sometimes it can also be seeing the past, seeing things that are, you know, that have taken place in certain places, and you can relive that event when you're there. But again, it's usually it's not something that you can train for. You can train perhaps to control it or to not have it frighten you, as it often does when it first manifests in people. But usually it's just a gift that is sort of unexplained and that is felt to be hereditary to run in certain lineages. I portray Vitrix as having that gift but not having it manifest yet.
Yeah.
So I show Lu because Lu is the power of illumination. So he basically manifests the gift so he can use it later on.
And before we go to phone calls, since we do have the time to take them this week, explain the grid, which is the antagonist in Vitrix.
Well, the grid was a way of, again, through comic book language, through using, you know, sort of simple and direct idea. The grid is the power of uniformity and compartmentalization. It's what basically puts the brakes on the free development and evolution of life, of real organic life on Earth. It's human culture at its most degrading and unliving, that is trying to reduce everything to the most simple common denominator and to force everybody into it for short-term gain. And so I present it here as something completely alien to human life. I mean, they're actually shown as alien creatures that are trying to impose this on the Earth. And you have people like Vitrix, or who can see the grid, can understand what they're doing, who are set against them, whereas other humans are shown as being very susceptible to what the grid has to
And you have the
offer.
Grid manipulating the Romans to destroy the Druidical College.
Exactly, yes.
They manipulate the police in France to try to stop Nolan from getting to the anti-nuclear demonstration.
Right, exactly. So that was basically a way of portraying all of these tendencies that I find dangerous and anti-life, anti-understanding the relationship between tribe and land.
Right.
In our culture, it was a way of presenting it in a kind of supervillain quality in the comic book, in which, of course, I go into it in more detail in the Apple Branch, describing it historically and culturally within the context of our life.
You sort of have you know, that sort of entity, both capitalism and communism, being the same aspects of that entity.
Yes, because they're after the same things. It's just who holds the power. That is slightly different, but not very different.
Anyway, let's take phone calls. Number here is 209-2900. This is WBAI FM 99.5 in New York City. And our guest is Alexei Kondratiev. You're on the air. Well, I guess you're not on the air. You're on the air.
I was on the web at the DC Superstar Society Shazam quiz. And question number three says, Doctor, what are names of the three boys who can become the three Lieutenant of Marvels? Man, don't laugh, man. Let me finish. Choice B is Jay Zilber, Ken Gale, Mark Flynn. How do you get your name on this, Mr. Gale?
That is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. I was one of the multiple choices for the three Lieutenant Marvels.
Did you write for Shazam? How you get your name on this?
No, I did not get my name on that because I wrote for Shazam. I got my name because Mike Gold, who wrote the quiz, I was friends with him, and decided.
Who's Jay Zilber and Mark Flynn? Are they associates of yours?
What he did was he put three
big fans
in Legion of Superheroes fandom, and that's what he did.
Hey, what do you think of Shazam cartoon show?
Haven't seen it. Do you have any questions for our guest?
Well, actually, yeah. I was wondering, like, with music, there's always, like, well, not always, but, like, people put clues in record albums. And anybody ever put, like, clues in comic books? You know, like, Paul is Dead for the Beatles or, like, stuff like that. Has there ever been, like, some kind of controversy with comic books where there's, like, a series of clues placed within the pages? And well, people, like, you know, find out, you know, in-jokes and things like that.
Well, there's not that kind of subtlety in Vitrix for that.
There are in-jokes for people who are, for instance, involved in Celtic movements or who come from a Celtic background, who know those communities. There are certain people who are mentioned, for instance, especially in the episode with Nolwenn, the modern one. Like, for instance, the harp teacher of the person who is... who has stolen the sacred harp that's the treasure that Vitrix is trying to find, is a real person who actually does teach harp in Brittany.
Oh, he is?
Yes. So nobody would know, you know, a normal reader would not pick up on that, but someone who actually is from Brittany and knows Celtic music, for instance, would realize that was a real person.
Oh, you're doing a little satire of him.
Yeah. No, it's not a satire. No, well, it's the teacher of the character.
And then you have at one point when the Viking sorceress is defeated, she can't imagine how Vitrix can call forth the goddess, because after all, he's a man.
Mm-hmm.
Which I remember you telling me, hearing that line from somebody.
Yes.
And you had to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess there's little in-jokes like that. But of course, nobody's ever noticed. I've been selling this comic since it came out, and nobody has noticed it. Nobody's asked me about this.
And of course, background inkers are always putting their names and their friends' names in the background.
Yeah, don't you, Ed?
In one comic, my name was signed to every painting in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
And I know one place to look for things like that is in those little squiggly lines in Doctor Strange's cape. But
like the Ninas in the Hirschfeld drawings?
Anyway, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you would talk about Stonehenge. You were talking about
Druids,
you know what I mean, that stone kind
of... Okay, sure.
Stonehenge.
And also, am I correct that you love Alley Oop?
Terribly.
Well, that was his magic word that says I can cut him off.
Right.
Stonehenge is pre-Celtic.
Yeah, it's pre-Celtic. It doesn't really have much to do with the Celtic world, except that, of course... the Celts were aware of it. It's a very weird thing out there in the landscape. And
how can you miss it?
Yes, exactly. So all the cultures that have came to Britain after it was built noticed it and did something about it or said something about it or made up stories
about
it.
Or used it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's part of Celtic tradition, even though it was not originated by the Celts. And
did the Celts ever claim it?
No. Well, they claimed that Merlin built it. That's part of, you know, native British Celtic tradition, Welsh tradition. It's called Gwaith Myrddin or Gwaith Emrys, which means the work of Ambrosius, which was Merlin's given name. He's said to have built it magically through levitating the stones, bringing them from the Preseli Hills, where that blue stone comes from.
That's the best explanation I've ever heard.
And sort of levitating them, bringing them over to Salisbury Plain. So, so they had a story about it, and they claimed to know the origin of it. But, of course, it existed way before the Celts got to Britain.
Mm-hmm. You're on the air.
Yeah, are you the same Ken Gale who was the guitarist for the Ken Gale Trio back in the 70s?
No, but I guess I could claim to be that, right? If people want to claim that they created Stonehenge, so why can't I claim that I was a guitarist? I'm like, you know, no, hardly. 209-2900 is the number here to want to speak to Alexei. Now, I thought it was interesting that when I was reading in the Apple Branch and I learned about the first golden age of the Celts and the second golden age of the Celts, and I'm rereading Viderix, I'm going, no, wait a minute. You've got the first story taking place at the end of the first golden age, mm-hmm. and the second story taking place at the end of the second golden age. Why did you use the endings?
Well, because that's when the characters leave that period to go in their journey through time, right? So it's sort of normal to leave at the end of an episode to start on another episode, basically because they've got nothing left to do there, right? Viderix's world is shattered.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens with Nechtan. Pretty much. I mean, you can see that that's the end of the period in which the monastery is going to be safe, and there's a...
And Nolwyn joins them at the when the Bretons manage to keep France from building a nuclear power plant in Brittany.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the height that France is building nuclear power plants all over the countryside.
Right.
And they didn't do it in the Celtic country. Which I thought was kind of neat.
And there would have been another episode after that where they go to Northern Ireland and we look at the situation there.
Yeah, it's. I hope someday to continue the story. You're on the air.
I have a question about your radio station.
What's that?
What's the frequency, Kenneth?
99.5 FM in New York. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
All right, what's up?
All right, I'm listening to your interview here. It's the first time I've ever listened to this radio station. I'm just curious to know, the character, I hope I get this right, Viderix?
Right.
Am I saying that correct?
Yeah.
Is that an actual character from Celtic mythology? Because I've just recently gotten into reading, and I've read a number of books about Lu Lomfada, obviously Louis the Long Arm, Cahulain, otherwise sometimes it's pronounced Cahulain. I was just wondering if the writer took this out of actual Celtic mythologies.
Well, the basic story makes a lot of allusions to Celtic literature and myth. Viderix himself now is a character that is made up by me. His name means Lord of Trees because he's an herbalist. He's someone who was originally trained as a druid to study herbs and their properties. But
and while the Romans are destroying the Druidical College, he's gathering yarrow, which is why he's not in the battle.
Right.
Okay.
And... it's Lu, actually, Lu Lomfada, whom you just mentioned, who sends him on his trip through time. So I use the background of Celtic mythology and Celtic literature and Celtic history to propel the story, but the characters are original characters.
You mind if I ask you another question?
Go ahead. Go ahead.
In reference to Celtic mythologies, I was a real big fan of Robert E. Howard.
Yeah.
And in reading a lot of his work, I'm finding out that... he really basically just had a real great smattering of Celtic mythological knowledge to create his Hyborian Age. And I was just wondering what your thoughts on are that, because his claim to fame is basically creating a bunch of characters, for instance, Conan the Barbarian, Cull, and those, Bran MacMorn, Cormac MacArthur. These are names right out of Celtic mythology. They're ripped right out
of
all the stories I've read. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Howard read what was published about Celtic mythology around the turn of the century, books by Charles Squire and Rolston and, of course, all of the Anglo-Irish revivalist writers like Lady Gregory and Yeats and A.E. who were using earlier Celtic literature for their own stories. And that was basically the notion of Celtic literature and Celtic mythology that he had then. And it was spliced onto the pop culture of the, the 20s and 30s. And nowadays, of course, I think that people who study Celtic culture and have learned a lot more about the Celts from archaeology, from new texts, from, you know, better understanding of what was there, would probably not come to the same conclusions that Howard did. He wouldn't have, they wouldn't have the same picture of the Celtic world that Howard did. Right. But Howard obviously liked a lot of the heroic aspects, like Cuchulainn, and he integrated episodes from those stories and the way he felt those characters should be into the creation of his own heroic characters.
Yeah,
one last question. I didn't get the name of the comic book. If I could get the name, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, the name of the comic book is Dangerous Times, and it's published by Evolution Comics. And the address for Evolution Comics is P.O. Box 1028, Gracie Station, New York, New York, 10028.
The only place to get those these days.
Yeah, or
show up at a Big Apple Con.
I will be at the Big Apple Con this Friday and Saturday. That's at the basement of the church that's on 9th Avenue between 59th and 60th.
Okay.
I will have the complete set of Dangerous Times and the Apple Branch. I'll have it at my table.
Okay.
And on Saturday, I'll be taping probably at least one interview for later broadcasting on these airwaves.
All right.
Okay.
Well, good luck with the comic.
All right.
I enjoy talking to you.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Yeah, and also, you're a member of the Celtic League,
right.
And they're having a conference on May 8th at the Irish Arts Center.
Mm-hmm.
How would people get more information on that? Well, what's the address of the Celtic League?
It's, I think it's 20185.
It's P.O. Box.
Yes, P.O. Box 20185.
20185.
Yeah, Dag Hammarskjöld Plaza, and that's New York, New York, 10017.
And the Celtic Conference is going to be full day, Saturday, May 8th. The Irish Arts Center is on 51st Street between 11th and 12th Avenue, closer to 12th.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alexei will be speaking there, and there'll be people talking about Celtic art. There'll be music and everything else.
I think it's 20153, actually.
20153, okay.
Yeah.
So, and the Irish Arts Center, it's in the phone book if you want to look them up. I'll try to have information at that at the Big Apple Con as well.
But, and next week on these airwaves.
Next week is R.C. Harvey and Jeff Lindenblatt will be helping me interview him. We'll be talking about comic strips. R.C. Harvey wrote The Art of the Comic Strip, The Art of the Comic Book, Children of the Yellow Kid. He does a column in the Buyer's Guide and the Comics Journal called Comicopia. He's quite a historian, almost as good as Jeffrey on comic strips. And the week after that, which will be our last week as part of City in Exile, we'll be taking your phone calls.
And next week, back on City in Exile, hopefully the return of the
Poison Darts
crew and our fearless leader.
I should
leader.
Say Poison Darts!
Oh, you did that pretty well. Oh, maybe you can be that as well as the king.
Oh, no.
Well, I don't know. Bob Dole says that you did that pretty darn good. So give me your paw. Anyway, it's just about time now to go to the rebroadcast of this evening's WBAI Evening News, which is coming up in just moments. Time enough for us to say goodbye and hope
and
that...
Thank you again, Alexei, for being our guest here on Upset.
Hope that you'll keep tuning in to WBAI and tune in next week for more Nuff Said and City in Exile. And I don't know. We'll just let the music go
let the music
for,
go,
for
yeah.
a few seconds and then the news.